Shadows whisper secrets unknown. Reflections lost in time shown. Shifting light of what's to be. Yearning for truth inside of me. I have called it, I'll allow it, let it be. Set the author free.
We are all storytellers. Every day, with every choice, we add a new line to the narrative of our lives. Welcome to part two, The Transformation. I am Jeanette Dunlop, author of Rewrite Your Story and my book of mantras, presenting another Netty collection, the Other You podcast, where curiosity rediscovers the version of you that's been buried under roles, routines, and expectations. The other you that still dreams, still feels, and still believes in more. Alongside your hosts, Ben Jenkins and Sarah Michaels, we'll talk about real change, mindset resets, and how to build a life that feels like yours again. Each episode invites you to pause, reflect, and reconnect with practical tools for confidence, purpose, and emotional balance. So take a breath. Open your heart and step into a conversation designed to remind you, you are not bound by yesterday. You are free to create the other you.
I have called it, I'll allow it, let it be, set the author free. I am authentic.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Today, we're really embarking on a deep dive into the very architecture of personal change.
Right.
We've compiled, well, what I think is a pretty intensive psychological toolkit. It's a synthesis of these high-impact strategies designed to move you, the listener, from simply reacting.
To just what life throws at you.
Exactly. From reacting to life to consciously and, you know, intentionally creating the life you actually want.
It's a huge mission, though. I mean, we are definitely not talking about quick fixes or some kind of superficial motivation here.
No, not at all.
We're trying to get into the mechanics of how successful people, the ones who always seem to understand the game of life a little better than others, how they manage their internal state.
And how they structure their actions and ultimately how they define their purpose.
Yeah. The big question we're asking is, what is the blueprint for a total, genuine personal reinvention?
We're going to try and address this by looking at three really powerful, interconnected pillars of source material. First, we have the immediate, action-oriented, you know, hands-on techniques of neuro-linguistic programming, or NLP.
Which is all about rewriting your internal operating script.
That's it. Then second, we integrate that sort of immediate action with the structural blueprint for effectiveness from Stephen Covey's Seven Habits.
A classic. And that map, it traces that crucial journey from relying on others, dependence, to self-mastery.
Independence,
and then finally to that higher level of meaningful collaboration, interdependence.
And finally, we will explore the definitive and I think the original and constantly evolving map of human motivation from Abraham Maslow.
And we're going to be really specific here, and we're focusing on the full hierarchy.
The full hierarchy, including that later critical stage of self-transcendence that, you know, it just profoundly redefines human potential and for some reason is so frequently left out of the common understanding of his model.
It's amazing how often it's just a five-step pyramid.
Right, and it's not.
So our goal today is to synthesize these three areas, the mental tools, the behavioral map, and the internal engine, to give you a complete psychological foundation for, well, for architecting your next chapter.
It's time to consciously rewrite your story.
Let's start where the rubber meets the road. Neuro-linguistic programming. The name itself, it sounds so technical, almost clinical.
It does. But at its heart, the source material defines it pretty simply. It's the study of how our thoughts systematically affect our behavior.
So it's like reverse engineering excellence.
That's a great way to put it. NLP looks at how the brain takes in signals, you know, data from the world, internal feelings, and then how it interprets them and how those interpretations create the patterns we fall into.
Both the good and the bad ones.
The helpful and the unhelpful, yeah.
And if you break down the name itself, you get those three core components that really define its scope. You've got the neuro component.
Which is the mind, the nervous system, basically how you think.
And then you layer in the linguistic part. Language.
And that's not just how we talk to other people. Crucially, it's about how we communicate with ourselves. That internal dialogue.
That little voice.
That's the one. It's often the governor on our potential, you know.
And then wrapping it all up is programming.
Which just refers to those automated patterns of behavior, how you act and react in the world. It's the observable output of the neuro and the linguistic parts working together.
So the big insight of NLP then is that this whole process, it isn't fixed.
Exactly. It's not set in stone.
Hmm.
By looking at the structure of your internal communication, these techniques help us see thoughts, feelings, emotions, not as things that just passively happen to us,
but as things we can actually control.
Mm.
Things we can influence.
You can actively change the focus of your thought. And as the source notes, where focus goes, energy flows.
I think this is probably why NLP has had such a broad appeal, especially in coaching and, you know, peak performance circles.
Oh, absolutely.
You look at someone like Tony Robbins. He adapted these core NLP techniques into his own system, which he calls neuroassociative conditioning. The focus is just explicitly, aggressively action-oriented.
And that contrast, the one the source material draws, is so vital for you to grasp. If traditional therapy often focuses on the why, like why did this pattern start? Why do you feel this way?
Which can take years to unpack.
It can. NLP is strictly focused on the how. How can you react differently right now? How can you interrupt that unhelpful pattern, install a new powerful association, and change your mindset so life starts happening for you, not to you?
It's not about endless analysis of your past. It's about revealing your internal map, finding those unproductive grooves.
The habits that make us feel stuck.
Exactly. And then actively writing a new map, a new story that replaces those patterns with empowering ones.
And because of that focus on immediate applied change, its uses are just incredibly versatile. You see mental health professionals using it, sometimes with talk therapy, to rapidly treat things like phobias, anxiety, panic attacks.
But it's just as powerful for purely aspirational growth. Things like public speaking, sales, negotiation.
Team building, leadership.
Ah.
It gives you practical, immediate ways to reprogram your brain to hit specific, concrete goals.
So let's get practical. Let's move from the philosophy to the actual toolkit. The source highlights 5 core techniques that are fantastic starting points for anyone looking to actively start rewriting that internal script.
Great. Let's start with the foundational one, a really accessible tool, imagery training. You might also hear it called mental rehearsal.
This is more than just daydreaming, though, isn't it?
Oh, way more. It's visualization taken to the point of neurological conviction. The key is to create a highly detailed, sensory-rich scene of yourself performing a difficult action successfully.
So it's not just, I see myself doing well. It's specific.
Hyper-specific. You have to engage all 5 senses. If you're visualizing nailing a big presentation, you need to feel the texture of the microphone in your hand. You need to hear the specific sound of the applause. You need to see the focused faces in the audience.
You even need to feel your own body language. Your shoulders back, head high, the actual physiological feeling of confidence.
Yes. The entire point of the exercise is to create absolute certainty in your nervous system. By rehearsing it at that high level of detail, you're essentially bypassing your inner critic. You're convincing your brain that this successful outcome has already happened. It becomes inevitable.
Okay, so that's imagery training. What's next?
Next up is the NLP swish. This one is much more kinetic. It's designed to train your brain to amplify positive associations and actively weaken negative ones. It's often used to disrupt an immediate impulse.
It sounds like a literal neurological trick, like brain-based editing.
That's a perfect description. So step one, you conjure a vivid, bright picture in your mind of the behavior you don't want. Maybe it's reaching for a cigarette. Make it big, bright, dominating your mental screen.
Okay.
Then step two, you create a small, dull, gray image of what you do want to replace it with. The desired behavior. Maybe it's a picture of you breathing fresh air, feeling healthy.
And then comes the swish.
Then comes the swish reversal. You rapidly, in a fraction of a second, bring that dull, positive image into the foreground. You make it bigger, brighter. You add color, motion, maybe even a triumphant internal soundtrack. And at the exact same time, you throw that unwanted negative image into the background, shrinking it, making it gray and colorless and blurry.
And the speed is the key here, isn't it?
Speed is everything. You repeat this swish 3 to 5 times. Snap, snap, snap. You're training your brain to amplify the positive and weaken the negative on a subconscious, lightning-fast level. It's a pattern interrupt.
Okay, technique 3, modeling. This one has gained huge traction, especially in the entrepreneurial world and with elite athletes.
Right, because it's based on that simple idea that success leaves clues.
And it taps directly into that behavioral principle that whatever you consistently think about and focus on, you move toward.
Exactly. If you surround yourself with mediocre outcomes, your brain starts to normalize mediocrity. So the action here is structural. You deliberately seek out successful role models. You find a mentor, join a mastermind group.
Or even just study someone you admire.
Yes. You focus on modeling their specific observable behaviors, their mindsets, their habits, even their language patterns. Instead of trying to reinvent the wheel, you just map the proven strategies of those who've already achieved what you want.
Technique 4 is mirroring. This is a communication tool, and it is remarkably effective for building instant trust and rapport.
It's all about making the other person feel comfortable and ultimately find you more trustworthy.
And this leverages that famous 7-38-55 rule of communication.
The one that reminds us that only 7% of our message is the actual words we use. 38% is our tone of voice, and a massive 55% is our nonverbal body language.
So mirroring is about gently matching that body language.
Gently is the key word. You match their energy level. If they're high energy and leaning forward, you reflect that back. If they're relaxed and leaning back, you reflect that calm. You can subtly match their posture, their breathing rhythm.
Even their vocabulary.
Yeah, adapting your vocabulary to mirror their style. The unconscious result is that their brain perceives you as being just like them, which makes them feel safe and builds this deep, instant connection.
Okay, finally, we have incantations.
These are basically affirmations on steroids. While an affirmation is a phrase you repeat about a goal, an incantation demands a crucial, non-negotiable addition. A change in your physiology.
So you're leveraging the body-mind connection. It's not just what you say, it's how your body says it.
It's about embodying the phrase with total physical intensity. You have to get into a peak state. You might be jumping, shouting, moving, creating a state of total unquestioning confidence.
The source material mentions Tony Robbins, right? He started these when he was just 17.
And still uses them today before huge events. It's a rapid, intense way to neurologically interrupt a state of fear and replace it with empowering certainty. You're combining intense words with an intense physical state. You are, quite literally, shouting down the doubt in your nervous system.
It really is a comprehensive, practical set of tools. I mean, the whole philosophy of NLP just fits so perfectly with that growth mindset, the belief that failure is just feedback.
And that we have the power to change our lives to be exactly what we want them to be.
Okay, so that gives us the micro tools. We know how to change a specific thought or a habit with, you know, neurological speed.
Mm-hmm.
But sustained, meaningful life change, that requires a macro plan. A structural roadmap.
That's the perfect transition. We move from the psychological technique to the philosophical blueprint. This is where Covey comes in.
This is the synthesis. We're reframing Covey's habits through the lens of rewriting our story. It's aligned so perfectly with a specific 7-step NLP framework for building healthy habits.
Right. This framework acts as a bridge. It takes the abstract power of NLP and applies it methodically to the challenge of habit formation. It shifts those deep-seated patterns at a subconscious level to replace self-doubt with real behavioral confidence.
So let's walk through those steps. It starts with clarity, right? Step one, set a well-formed outcome.
Yes. This is where we apply that crisp, positive, specific NLP language. The goal has to be positive, what you do want, not what you want to avoid. It has to be specific and sensory rich.
So you move beyond those vague goals like lose weight or be less stressed.
Those are motivation killers. Instead, you aim for sensory clarity. I feel strong, energized, and proud as I move through my day and my clothes fit effortlessly. Your brain knows exactly what that success feels and looks like.
Step two. Anchor desired emotional states. We touched on anchoring as a core NLP technique, and here it is again.
And here we apply it directly to combat resistance. You recall a peak state, that moment you felt supremely motivated or disciplined, and you link it to a unique physical gesture, tapping your fist, grasping your wrist, something like that.
And then when you face that friction point, the moment you want to skip the gym,
you activate the anchor. And you instantly recall that massive peak state, which makes it neurologically easier to choose the desired behavior over the path of least resistance. You're accessing a positive emotional memory on demand.
Step three, use swish patterns, the immediate powerful interrupt for any unwanted habit.
Exactly. You visualize the old behavior procrastinating, hitting snooze, and you rapidly swish in the new, desired, bright, and moving behavior. You just repeat it rapidly to overwrite that negative association.
Step 4, reframe limiting beliefs. This feels like maybe the most important step, because our internal self-talk is the engine of failure, isn't it?
It really is. You have to catch those cognitive distortions, that limiting generalization like, I'm just not a morning person, or all my ideas fail.
You actively reframe it.
You reframe it to an empowering possibility. I'm learning to energize my mornings with movement, or I'm gathering data to improve my next proposal.
And this is where the source brings up meta-model questions. Can you explain what those are?
Yeah, they're the key tool here. If someone says, I can't succeed, that's a generalization. The meta model question challenges the depth of that belief. So if you catch yourself saying, I always mess this up, a meta model question would be, always, can you remember one time you didn't?
So you're forcing your brain to look for evidence that contradicts the limiting belief.
Precisely. If the belief is, it's impossible to save money, you ask, impossible for who? Specifically, how is it impossible? These questions force the brain to challenge the generalization and seek concrete, realistic data. It breaks the trance.
Okay, step 5. Future pace your success.
This is where you lock the new habit into your identity. You mentally rehearse success over and over, visualizing not just the action, but the long-term benefit. You embed the habit not just as something you do, but as part of who you are.
So it's not, I go to the gym, it's, I am a person who takes care of my body daily.
That's the shift. Step 6 is chunk down the habit, or habit stacking. This is all about making the change feel manageable.
Preventing that overwhelm that kills motivation.
Right. You break a big goal, like write a book into a micro-habit, write one page after dinner.
And the power of habit stacking is linking that new micro-habit to something you already do without thinking.
Yeah. After I pour my first cup of coffee, I will plan my top 3 tasks for the day. Or after brushing my teeth, I will stretch for 2 minutes. You leverage existing momentum.
Finally, step 7, calibrate progress and adjust.
You have to adopt that NLP mindset that failure is just feedback. It's not your identity. You ask, what's working? What can I tweak? And you reinforce it all with positive self-talk. The core principle here is just that daily, non-judgmental approach. Compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not who someone else is today.
That NLP framework is such a practical toolkit. And now we layer that onto the macro framework of Covey. His model is explicitly inside out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The philosophy is that all enduring change has to start within you and then work its way outward into your relationships and your effectiveness in the world.
And the structure is just genius. The habits are a journey, moving from dependence.
Relying on others for your outcomes.
To independence, which is self-mastery, the private victory.
And finally, to interdependence, which is effective collaboration, the public victory. And then habit 7 is the engine that keeps it all going.
So let's focus on those first 3 habits. The private victory, which is all about achieving independence.
Habit 1, be proactive. This is the foundation. It's about taking full responsibility for your reaction in that space between a stimulus and your response.
The source links this to Viktor Frankl.
It does. We have the power to choose our response no matter what's happening around us. Practically, this means focusing your energy on your circle of influence, the things you can actually control, not endlessly worrying about the circle of concern.
And holding the pen to your own narrative.
You're the author, which leads directly to habit 2. Begin with the end in mind. This is all about vision and clarity. Covey says all things are created twice. First, a mental creation, then a physical one.
So you have to define the life and legacy you want first.
You have to. If habit 1 established that you're the programmer, habit 2 is when you sit down and actually write the program before you start trying to execute the code.
Which brings us to habit 3. But first things first. This is where you execute the program you just wrote. This is about prioritizing your new values over your old habits.
This relies heavily on that powerful tool, the Eisenhower Matrix, which separates tasks based on urgency and importance.
And this is where most of us fail, isn't it? The goal is to spend most of our time in quadrant 2. Not urgent, but important.
That's the zone of long-term development, strategic planning, relationship building, exercise, prevention. These are the activities that actually drive your new story forward.
But they're so easy to put off in favor of urgent, visible distractions. The emails, the phone calls.
Revert the 3.
Or the high-stress crises of quadrant 1. We avoid quadrant 2 because it requires proactive planning and discipline. It has no immediate deadline, so our lizard brain just defaults to what's screaming the loudest. Covey stresses that true effectiveness means resisting the tyranny of the urgent.
Okay, so once you achieve that private victory, you're independent, self-managed, you can move to the next 3 habits. The public victory, which is about interdependence. Habit 4, Think win-win. This is about reframing your relationships from a competitive or even self-sacrificing mindset to one where you are always seeking mutually beneficial outcomes.
It's a character-based code, not a quick-fix technique.
Right. It requires courage and consideration. And then habit 5. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. This is a profound habit. It's about rewriting how you listen.
It requires empathetic listening with the intent to genuinely understand the other person's frame of reference before you even try to make your own point.
And this connects powerfully to the old Greek modes of persuasion. Covey says effectiveness follows this order. First is ethos, your personal credibility, the trust you inspire. Second is pathos, the empathy, showing you understand them emotionally. And only then comes logos, your logic and reasoning.
If you jump straight to logic without establishing trust and empathy, nobody's listening.
They've already shut down. Which leads to habit 6, synergize. This is the culmination of the first 5. It's inviting others into your story, combining strengths through positive teamwork to achieve goals no one could achieve alone. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts.
And the whole model is maintained by habit 7, sharpen the saw, continuous renewal.
Balancing and renewing your physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional resources. Covey calls this the upward spiral. Through consistent progress, you get growth, change, and constant improvement. The cycle is simple. Learn, commit, do. At progressively higher levels.
It's an incredible synthesis. Covey gives you the map, and NLP gives you the compass and the tactical tools to navigate it.
Together, they provide the infrastructure for a total overhaul of your personal story.
We have the tools, we have the map. So now, we turn inward to the deepest driving force of all, the internal engine of human motivation. We're getting into the work of Abraham Maslow, starting with his huge 1943 paper.
Maslow's work really is the foundational text for so much of modern psychology. But, you know, as our source material reveals, the original context and especially the later editions are just vital to really understanding motivation.
So his theory is that human needs arrange themselves in a hierarchy of prepotency. What exactly does prepotency mean?
It just means that the satisfaction of one need rests on the prior satisfaction of a more powerful or primary need. So if your most fundamental need is unmet, it completely dominates your consciousness and your behavior.
He has that great quote, "Man is a perpetually wanting animal."
It's a bit chilling, but it captures that continuous dynamic nature of motivation. And the critical point is that motivation is driven by unsatisfied needs. A satisfied need is neurologically quiet. It just stops being an active motivator.
So let's start at the base of the pyramid. The physiological needs: breathing, food, water, sleep. These are the most prepotent.
Right. Maslow noted that in a person who is missing everything in an extreme way, food, safety, love, esteem, the major motivation would most likely be exclusively these physiological needs. Nothing else would matter.
He even rejected the typical hunger drive as a model for motivation.
He did, because physiological drives are often isolable and localizable. You can point to the specific physical discomfort. They are the most primal and dominating drives.
And to illustrate this dominance, he paints this really vivid picture of extreme deprivation.
Yeah, if the organism is dominated by these needs, all other needs just become non-existent.
He talks about the chronically and dangerously hungry man. He says this person literally thinks, dreams, and emotes only about food. His capacity for love or philosophy or art just vanishes.
It changes his entire definition of the future. For the extremely hungry man, utopia is just a place with plenty of food. He'd wave aside freedom or community as irrelevant fripperies.
That's where his famous line comes from. It is quite true that man lives by bread alone when there is no bread.
But, and this is the crucial clarification, in a normally functioning, peaceful society, chronic extreme hunger is rare. Most of us experience appetite, not life and death hunger. If you want to obscure the higher motivations in a person, you have to make them chronically struggle at that base level.
Okay, so once physiological needs are relatively satisfied, the safety needs emerge.
And these, too, can completely dominate the organism if they're threatened. It can become a safety-seeking mechanism.
Well, you see these needs most clearly in infants and children, right? Because they don't have that adult inhibition of fear.
Exactly. Their world seems unstable when they encounter loud noises or rough handling or illness. A child desperately needs a predictable, orderly world. They need routine. Injustice or inconsistency from a parent makes the world look unsafe. The parent is their all-powerful protector.
But in a healthy adult, these needs are more subtle. The desire for job tenure, a savings account, insurance.
Or just a preference for the familiar over the unknown. But Maslow also noted the terrifying implications when safety is thwarted. He says in neurosis, the individual acts as if a catastrophe were always impending.
And this is where he specifically mentions seeking a protector, or a Führer. That's a heavy word given the context of 1943.
It is. It's profound. He says the compulsive obsessive individual frantically tries to order and stabilize the world with rules and formulas, desperately trying to prevent the unexpected. What's a mild preference for routine and a healthy person becomes a life and death necessity in abnormal cases. The desire for a strong, singular protector, a Führer, is the psychological result of a deep safety deficit.
So when the world feels unpredictable and dangerous, the only thing that matters is external order and security, even at the expense of freedom.
Even at the expense of higher values.
Moving up the hierarchy, if physiological and safety needs are met, the love and belonging needs emerge.
This is that profound hunger for affectionate relations, friends, family, a place in a group.
And Maslow said that thwarting these needs is the most common core of maladjustment and psychopathology.
It's the psychological illness that comes from a lack of connection. And he was careful to note that love is not the same as sex, which can be purely physiological, even though they're often intertwined.
Next are the esteem needs. This is the desire for a stable, high evaluation of oneself based on real achievement.
And he divided this into two sets. First, the internal esteem, the desire for strength, achievement, confidence, independence, freedom. Second, the external esteem, the desire for reputation, prestige, respect from others, recognition, attention.
And satisfying these leads to genuine self-confidence. Thwarting them leads to feelings of inferiority, weakness, helplessness. This is where a lot of people in our society are motivated, right?
A lot of people spend their lives here. After esteem, we finally arrive at self-actualization.
The desire for self-fulfillment, the tendency to become actualized in what one is, potentially. A musician must make music. An artist must paint.
But the clear emergence of this need rests entirely on the prior satisfaction of the lower four needs. Maslow admitted that since basically satisfied people are the exception, we don't know much about self-actualization. It's hard to study.
We also need to loop back to the cognitive needs.
Yes, which Maslow saw as separate but necessary drivers. The desire to know and to understand. And crucially, he said they are conative. They have a striving, goal-directed character, just like the other needs.
The desire to know is the drive to be aware of reality, get facts, satisfy curiosity. Then comes the desire to understand.
Which is the impulse to systematize, organize, look for relations and meanings. Like finding a unifying philosophy for your life. Mm-hmm. And he even created a little hierarchy here, saying the desire to know, to gather facts, is prepotent over the desire to understand, to organize those facts.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting. Because the model most of us learned in school, the five-stage pyramid, is incomplete.
It's totally incomplete. Maslow didn't stop at five stages. His final rectified model had six, with a profound shift at the very top.
He actually developed compelling doubts about self-actualization being the ultimate end goal.
He did. He realized he had conflated healthy content individuals with those who experienced a higher transpersonal state. He made this subtle but critical distinction. He differentiated between people who were merely healthy self-actualizers, content, fulfilled people, and what he called B people, those operating in the realm of being cognition.
So you could be symptom-free and satisfied at the SA level, feeling great about your achievements, and still not even be aware of this higher realm.
Exactly. Self-actualization is about me becoming everything I can be. The later model places the highest form of human development at a transpersonal level.
Where the self and the ego and its needs are transcended. This is self-transcendence, the sixth and final motivational step.
Self-transcendence is defined by motivation that moves beyond the self. It involves seeking a benefit that is not purely personal. This is service to others, devotion to a cause like social justice, or an ideal like truth or art.
And this is often expressed through what he called peak experiences.
Mystical, aesthetic, or transpersonal moments of profound unity. Maslow called the cognitive activity during these experiences being cognition or be cognition.
And be cognition fundamentally changes how you experience reality.
It does. While essay level motivation might lead you to seek fame or perfect a skill for your own satisfaction, transcendent motivation means you seek the be values, truth, goodness, beauty, unity, justice, as ends in themselves. Your achievement is in service to these greater principles, not just your own prestige.
The implications of this are huge. It gives us a framework for understanding altruism, social progress, wisdom.
Right. Sternberg's balance theory of wisdom explicitly involves balancing interpersonal and extrapersonal interests, the desire to contribute to something larger than yourself.
And this framework even gives us a language to discuss the dark side of transcendence.
Yes, it provides a psychological framework for understanding things like religious extremism or suicidal terrorism, where individuals surrender their personal needs to a cause they see as being beyond the self.
It also brings the whole theory into alignment with so many other spiritual traditions, Hindu, yogic, shamanic, where the highest goal has always been about moving beyond the personal self.
The highest goal isn't self-fulfillment, it's self-surrender to a higher value. And this all comes back to Maslow's conclusion about what happens when these needs are thwarted. He suggested that a person thwarted in any of his basic needs can be seen as a sick man.
A direct parallel to someone who lacks essential vitamins.
Exactly. If a healthy person is primarily motivated by the needs to develop and actualize their potential and then transcend, then a person who is actively and chronically seeking only money or safety or basic love, they're simply an unhealthy, thwarted person.
Which is why the Covey structure is so powerful. It provides the framework habits 1 through 3 to cure that psychological sickness and achieve independence, which then allows you to finally focus your energy on the higher needs of esteem, self-actualization, and ultimately transcendence.
So we have the internal map for motivation and the external frameworks for effectiveness. But operating at that level of self-actualization or interdependence, well, it's exhausting if you don't prioritize maintenance.
Right. The ascent up the hierarchy or the commitment to Covey's habits, it all requires continuous renewal and resilience.
This brings us back emphatically to Covey's 7th habit, sharpen the saw.
And the source material really addresses that painful, common habit so many of us fall into, leaving ourselves for last. We service the car, we update the laptop.
But we ignore the biological and psychological machine we're living in. The example of prioritizing a car service over a health check is just... it's painfully relatable.
We have to reframe this mindset. The argument here is firm. Self-care is not selfish, it's sacred.
It's the essential, continuous renewal of your physical, mental, spiritual, and emotional resources that creates a sustainable, effective lifestyle.
I love the specific language the source uses to describe this reframing. It is the quiet decision to rest without guilt, to nourish without shame, to say no without explanation. It's about setting boundaries that protect your ability to operate at your best.
When you commit to sharpen the saw, you build strength from within. It leads to sharper boundaries, restored joy, clearer thinking. You become a more authentic, effective version of yourself. This habit is the non-negotiable fuel for that whole upward spiral of improvement we talked about in the Covey model.
And speaking of physiological and mental renewal, the Wim Hof method is introduced as a transformative practice to help us actively regulate our nervous system. We're focusing just on the breathing component here as a tool for interrupting anxious states.
Yeah, this practice is explicitly focused on building resilience and regaining physiological control over that fight or flight system. It's a gateway to self-awareness and control.
The 5 steps start simply. Find a comfortable position, safe, relaxed, supported. Then you move into the active part. 30 to 40 deep breaths. You inhale completely, fill your lungs, and then just let the exhale go effortlessly.
Right, it's a rhythmic pace, a kind of hyperoxygenation. And the source notes that tingling or lightheadedness is normal. That's your nervous system reacting to the shift in CO2 and oxygen level.
Then comes the breath retention. After the final exhale, you just hold your breath for as long as you comfortably can. You quiet your mind and just observe.
It's incredibly centering. Then the recovery breath. A deep inhale held for 10 to 15 seconds, you release, and then you repeat the whole process for 3 or 4 rounds.
Finally, you transition into mindfulness and integration, just sitting in silence. The benefit here is the ability to regulate your nervous system on demand, to silence mental noise and interrupt anxiety or self-doubt.
You're teaching your body that you are safe, even when your mind is telling you that you're not.
And I love the real-world anecdote shared in the source material, because it shows how this can replace old, limiting habits. It's the story of someone habitually relying on coffee as a pause button to switch between roles.
Yes. Specifically, before stepping into the identity of motherhood, the coffee break was this mandatory physical ritual of transition. But it was replaced by a much more powerful physiological one.
So instead of needing that external stimulant, the individual started pulling up in the driveway and just doing the Wim Hof breathing for 10 minutes before walking inside.
That small intentional shift. It reclaims the pen. It begins the next chapter from a place of clarity and neurological strength, not from reliance on an external cue. It's the ultimate expression of Covey's proactivity and Maslow's self-actualization.
You're taking control of your internal state. And the core wisdom of Wim Hof just reinforces the whole theme of this deep dive. You are stronger than you think you are.
So we connect all these frameworks back to the challenge of growth itself, the idea of stepping into a new identity. Because growth inevitably brings new problems. Once you achieve self-actualization, what's next?
That's where the analogy of the glass ceiling or the next door comes in. Steve Harvey talked about getting to the next level by being prepared to break through that glass ceiling, which requires facing challenges and taking risks.
And Kevin Hart used that great metaphor. He was thrilled to get into the first room of success, only to realize once he was inside that there was another door you couldn't possibly see before.
Success and growth reveal new opportunities, new doors that were literally invisible from your previous level of existence.
But stepping through that door involves risk. And risk involves change, which leads to the really honest discussion about the fear of outgrowing people. As you change and grow using these tools, you will inevitably outgrow people who are comfortable in their current mindset.
And this doesn't mean you dismiss them cruelly, but it means you have to be aware of those who might be unintentionally keeping you small. They want you to remain the person they're comfortable with.
Letting go is a necessary act of courage for the mastery and interdependence required to pursue those higher levels of Maslow's hierarchy.
And finally, we look at this profound lesson on humility and support from the blindfolded goal exercise anecdote.
This is such a powerful story. The individual writes a secret goal, puts it in a bucket, and then tries to cross a football field blindfolded to find it.
And they fail, repeatedly. The frustration builds, leading to this immense internal shame and self-attack, the inside voice saying, "You are a failure. This simple task is impossible for you."
Success only came when the individual finally broke down and accepted help from others, allowing themselves to be guided by external voices. And the final uncontrollable tears weren't tears of joy from reaching the goal.
They were tears of shame, fueled by that internal voice. This didn't count because I couldn't do it on my own.
And the profound healing lesson from the leader of that exercise was that the detours and frustrations, they aren't signs of failure. They're signals on the journey. Your goal is yours, but you are not meant to reach it alone.
Humility asking that Covey-esque question, who can support me in my next step, is absolutely necessary for self-transcendence.
You can't control others, but you can control and influence yourself without judgment or blame. In life, if you don't risk anything, you risk everything. These frameworks we've discussed today, they equip you not just to see the next door, but to walk confidently through it.
Recognizing that sometimes the most courageous action is accepting a guiding hand.
So what does this all mean? We've covered a vast territory today, creating what I think is a comprehensive three-pillar toolkit for personal reinvention.
To summarize the major takeaways for your next chapter, NLP gives you the clarity and the neurological language, the swish, anchors, imagery, to immediately rewrite your internal script.
To replace those limiting beliefs with absolute certainty.
Then Covey's habits give you the structure. That inside-out philosophy that organizes your time and energy, moving you from dependence to purposeful independence.
Governed by those quadrant two activities.
And then on to fruitful interdependence.
And Maslow's hierarchy, now that we understand all six levels, including that critical stage of self-transcendence, it serves as a motivational map. It confirms that the highest, most fulfilling goals, they aren't selfish. They involve service and values beyond the self.
And crucially, renewal sharpens the saw, the Wim Hof breathing. That's the non-negotiable habit that sustains this entire ascent. It's the engine that keeps the movement going.
And we have to remember Maslow's point. The individual is either motivated by a satisfied need or an unsatisfied one. So if a truly healthy person is primarily motivated by the need to actualize their potential and then eventually transcend the self, this raises a provocative question for you, the listener.
The B values truth, goodness, beauty, unity. Are the values required for self-transcendence. So what intentional action will you take this week to move beyond the esteem stage and organize your life around those B values?
Which door, previously invisible, are you now ready to step through, knowing that seeking help is a sign of strength, not of weakness?
Consider these final questions for reflection. What specific NLP habit, the swish, an anchor, an incantation, will you apply immediately to interrupt a limiting belief?
Which highly effective habit from Covey, especially a Q2 activity, will you prioritize? How will meditation or self-care serve your reinvention? And most importantly, what current habit or relationship might be hindering your ability to open that next door?
That's our deep dive for today. We hope this comprehensive toolkit helps you architect your next most powerful chapter.
We wish you clarity and courage on the other side of whatever door you choose next.
Enjoy your week and catch you then.
Through the quiet, I feel the spark guiding me out of the endless dark. Every scar becomes a sacred key, opening the pathway back to me.
This was the last episode from part 2. So as we wrap up today's episode, I want to take a moment to honor the journey we've traveled together. I'm Jeanette Dunlop, author of Rewrite Your Story and my book of mantras. Part 2 has been about releasing what no longer serves you, the self-doubt that whispers you're not enough, the old patterns that have kept you small, and the fears that have held onto your identity far longer than they deserve to. We explored the resilience formula, uncovering your ability to rise again, not by avoiding challenges, but by learning from them. We stepped into boundaries, toxic people, and emotional freedom, recognizing that your energy is precious, your peace is sacred, and that you have permission and the right to walk away from what drains you. Then we moved into communication mastery, where you learned the power of expressing yourself with clarity, confidence, and compassion. Because the way you speak to others and to yourself shapes the way you live. And finally, we explored reinventing your career, taking ownership of your path, your purpose, and the vision you want to bring forward. Everything you've learned in part 2 has prepared you for what comes next. Because next week, we step into part 3, the new story. This is where integration becomes expansion, where the tools become a lifestyle, where the healing transforms into growth. Together, we'll explore your personal growth blueprint, how to commit to lifelong growth, and what it truly means to have the courage to reinvent at any age. Your new chapter isn't waiting for permission, it's waiting for you. So take a breath, take the lessons with you, and keep turning the page. Your story is far from finished, and the best part is still ahead.
Let the morning find you, leave the night behind. Soft beams of golden promise painting skies above. Carrying forgiveness, a gentle gift of love. Step by step, you're rising, petals in the air. Every footfall brighter, breathing newfound care.